Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Healthy Market Buoys Office Lease Rates. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. If you are looking for office space in the Triangle, here is a surprise. Rental rates are going up, and in some cases have gone up more than 20% in recent quarters. That may be enough for you to redraw that business plan with a new set of estimates for lease expenses in the coming years. Why? Because local commercial real estate professionals believe there are pockets in the Triangle where demand for workspace is growing faster than the existing supply, a scenario that may be tough to digest for some businesses looking to relocate or expand. But one needs to put everything in context. When MetLife executive Marty Lippert was analyzing the costs and benefits of consolidating the company's global technology and operations staff into a hub campus, one of the biggest financial factors, he says, was rent. MetLife could continue paying $98 per square foot annually for office space in New York City, or it could pay $26 per square foot for space in a brand new building overlooking a 520-acre lake in North Carolina. It made sense, Lippert said during a November celebration of the groundbreaking of MetLife's new 427,000-square-foot Cary campus. While an asking rate of $26 per foot would seem low in New York, it's still on the high end of Class A rental rates in the Triangle for now. The average asking rate for Class A office space in the fourth quarter was $21.42 per square foot, according to a report by the Avison Young commercial real estate firm, and that rate has remained steady for about 5 years. But with the Triangle real estate market turning a corner and a dwindling number of Class A buildings with vacant office space, property owners and landlords, like Highwoods Properties and Spectrum Properties, are becoming less generous with concessions and have started raising rental rates again. Nationally, asking rates for Class A office space is projected to increase 2.8%, the largest gain since 2007, according to real estate research firm Rice Incorporated. In the Triangle, Class A office rent could increase as much as 4% by year-end, says Maida Randhawa, a Raleigh market analyst for Jones Lang LaSalle. Rents are going to go up because of all the new construction, she says. It's been so long since we've had any new construction, they will, of course, attract the best price. In the past 6 months, construction has begun on 6 new office buildings that will add a combined 1.2 million square feet of space to the Triangle office inventory in 2015, and 74% of that space has been pre-leased. Asking rates for each of the new buildings ranges from $23.50 to $28.50 per square foot. Rental rates are unquestionably going to be higher this year, says Rich Harris, managing director of Synergy Commercial Advisors in Morrisville, who has helped corporate tenants like Cary-based SciQuest and Raleigh-based Bandwidth negotiate office lease contracts. When you don't have supply coming online, there begins to be a squeeze. Harris says that businesses needing between 5,000 and 10,000 square feet still have plenty of options in the region. But space for larger users is getting very difficult to find, he says. A lot of folks are talking about building new buildings, but that can take 15 months. What happens in between? The newer, more speculative office buildings, like the Charter Square office high-rise in downtown Raleigh, and the 300,000-square-foot Tower 2 office building at North Hills, are advertising asking rates of $29.95 and $33.95 per square foot, respectively. The most expensive Triangle buildings are asking $32 at East 54 in Chapel Hill and $31.95 at CapTrust Tower at North Hills in Raleigh, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly Commercial Real Estate Space Survey. John Linderman, managing director of Avison Young in Raleigh, says landlords aren't likely to raise rates unreasonably, but as construction costs, taxes, and operation costs rise, it's a matter of supply and demand. For several years, it's been a strong tenant market with an abundance of space where a tenant could negotiate 1, 2, three buildings against each other, he says, but landlord costs have continued to go up, and they've been caught in the middle. It has to be a situation that is fair to both sides. It's a delicate balance. And the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is taken up with the beginning of the cover story that has first the headline in bold red letters, All the President's Players, Why Obama Chose NC State and How the Science Could Change How America is Powered. And under that, there's a large picture of President Barack Obama speaking at NC State with the caption, President Barack Obama announced the creation of a clean energy manufacturing institute based at NC State University on January 15. And this article is written by Lauren Onsorge with the Dateline of Raleigh. Stakes are high for Raleigh, and the White House isn't the only one watching. Experts say a $70 million federal contract announced last week at NC State University by President Barack Obama could create an entirely new industry, one aimed at creating local jobs and making the country more competitive against electronic powerhouses in Asia. With the news that Raleigh has won the prize, that industry will officially be centered at NCSU's Centennial Campus, but it didn't come without a fight. Raleigh had at least two competitors battling for the 1,000 jobs that the Innovation Hub is expected to bring. The Albany-based SUNY College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering was one of the three contract finalists, and media outlets have pointed to Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico as the third contender. But it was the North Carolina proposal, which teams NCSU with private companies such as Cree and John Deere, that won that contest, meaning it's the Triangle's job to succeed in a project that had been in the works since before July, when the Funding Opportunity Announcement, FOA, was first issued by the U.S. Department of Energy. The state of North Carolina, several universities, and the private enterprise are expected to chip in an additional $70 million for the five-year project. Raleigh's is the second such hub selected, following an additive manufacturing center in Youngsville, Ohio. Starring in ours is a different type of semiconductor, one that has both higher voltage and heat capabilities than what's in today's computers. While listeners to Obama's speech may not have understood the buzzword of the day, wide bandgap semiconductor, they did understand that it meant 1,000 jobs. Expectations are high, so Raleigh must deliver. The man behind the science. One man in the crowd could barely contain himself when he heard Obama say, Wide Bandgap Semiconductor, or WBGS. Jay Baliga, that's spelled B-A-L-I-G-A, professor and director of the Power Semiconductor Research Center at NCSU, says WBGS will change the world forever, which the National Medal of Technology and Innovation winner has believed since he developed the equation in 1980 at General Electric. Using that equation, I predicted these wide-gap semiconductors would be 1,000 times better than silicon devices. That was a very strong motivator to investigate making those devices. Instead of the traditional silicon used to power everything from a smartphone to an energy transformer, WBGS uses a different material, silicon carbide. In the late 1980s, NCSU's material science department was a leader in its creation. That's why Baliga left General Electric to start his first consortium, NCSU's Power Semiconductor Research Center, where his team made the first high-performance, wide-bandgap silicon carbide power devices in the early 1990s. The main difference between the semiconductors that currently power smartphones and WBGS is that silicon carbide can withstand higher voltages and work at much higher temperatures than silicon alone. The technology isn't new, as Cree, a Durham company known for its LED capabilities, was founded on the science, but it has taken decades for WBGS to be widely implemented due to the difficulty of manufacturing the materials and costs involved. The technology can efficiently run transformers, capturing and distributing solar and wind energy, but the math has to add up for it to make business sense. The goal of the consortium is to speed up the commercialization of the technology and create new ways to manufacture the materials. I think we'll get a big push to further commercialize and reduce the cost of this technology so it can be competitive with silicon devices and improve the efficiency of high-powered electronics. While many semiconductor firms making high-power devices from traditional silicon might like to make the transition to WBGS, there's a big drawback: high cost. Addressing that challenge is the purpose of the Institute. Driving the cost down and increasing the production volume will enable the technology to penetrate the power electronics market in the industrial, consumer, transportation, lighting, and renewable energy sectors, Beliga says. A brand new industry? Beliga doesn't just see 1,000 new jobs, he sees the potential for an entirely new industry, and he's not alone. Neil Hunter, co-founder of Durham-based LED giant Cree, one of the firms selected for the initiative, says the news could give the Triangle a new moniker as a hub for the energy-efficient economy. I would say that what is new is the realization of the impact that energy efficiency has on our economy, he says. Whether we're talking about lighting systems that save 80% plus over existing technology, or power distribution systems that can save 5% of the power required for operation, these are game-changing disruptions in systems that have been technology stagnant for years. Alan Burkett, Senior Vice President for Business Development at ABB, another of the 18 companies in the new research consortium, agrees. I've heard it described as, our parents grew up with transistors, you and I are used to semiconductors in our phones, this may be the technology for our kids someday, he says, predicting high-voltage devices first, then low-voltage devices such as cell phones. While Beliga says we'll see this technology widespread in our own generation, Steve Hellenius, COO of New and Emerging Initiatives at the Semiconductor Research Center, suggests tempering expectations. The someday is doubtful for all of silicon devices, he says. The bulk of the silicon that's being used in your cell phone, in your computers every day, in your car, most of that are microprocessors and memory, which work at very low voltages, and the future of those devices is to work at lower and lower voltages in order to consume less and less power. Wide bandgap semiconductors don't work very well at low voltages. But he doesn't want to dampen the game-changing potential. It will do things that semiconductors can't do right now. There are possibilities of having very high, efficient replacements for transformers, things that are big and bulky and require a lot of copper. Potential applications. The biggest application could be in the renewable energy field, such as wind and solar power, Hellenius says. Large transformers convert that into a format that the power grid can use. He points to another increasingly common term in the power conversation, smart grids. A lot of the power grid that exists in the United States and around the world is dumb, in the sense that power gets stepped up or stepped down and goes to cities, and if you have a big disruption, for instance, sometimes it can cause a catastrophic blackout. He says, adding that a smart grid allows you to anticipate those things and balance power loads. That power management can be done very effectively with these kinds of wideband gap semiconductors. It allows that kind of voltage transition and power transition functions to be done with electronics that you can put some intelligence into. The increasing focus on alternative energies such as wind and solar is creating demand. The technologies used in LED lights, he says, also create supply. There's been more and more volume production because of LED lighting and things like that, which allows the cost effectiveness of manufacturing these materials and the growth of crystals and things like that to be defined, he says. The confluence of demand and improvements in materials are why the timing is right to commercialize the technology. And there's also an article related to the cover story with the headline, 18 companies join consortium. These companies is the glory and goodwill to be in front of an initiative that could change the way the world consumes energy. Among the companies in the consortium, several of them have a sizable footprint in the Triangle, including ABB, Cree, Grid Bridge, Delta Products, and Vacon, that's spelled V-A-C-O-N. One of the companies that spun out from the center, Raleigh's Grid Bridge, is the smallest firm in the consortium, but CEO Chad Eckert insists his 10-employee team is up to the challenge of working with industry giants. "You're not necessarily taking a risk when you have a company that has been doing this for the past couple of years," he says. Grid Bridge's point of interest is creating solutions to modernize the electrical grid, partnering with electric utilities to implement those solutions. And its day-to-day job, just as with the other 17 private entities involved in the consortium, would really change. What will change is access. Goal: commercialization. The Institute will allow Grid Bridge access to costly equipment and big-name collaborators, assets a company Grid Bridge's size would find hard to come by alone. It will also allow for new hires for both the small and big players in the consortium. "We have planned technical resources that are part of this program, so there are multiple people that we plan to hire," he says, adding that the exact number will be fleshed out when the contract is finalized. Vaken, the Finnish AC drive manufacturer, whose Research Triangle Park outpost hosted a visit from President Barack Obama just prior to his speech, says it too will be adding jobs as part of its involvement in the consortium. "As the president mentioned in his speech, it's not just about research and innovation, it's also about commercializing those innovations," says Sebastian Linko, spokesperson for Vaken. "So I guess we are one of those companies that would be using them." Vaken says his team in RTP will be developing new medium-voltage drive products using the technology, as opposed to the low-voltage AC drives it's traditionally known for. ABB, a power and automation technology giant that focuses on utility and industry customers, also plans to hire. The firm has its North American headquarters in Cary and two floors at Centennial Campus in Raleigh focused on research. It's also about to expand into another three floors at Centennial's Alliance One building. Its role will include research and development and testing around the wide bandgap semiconductor technology. "We invest well north of $1 billion every year in R&D, says Alan Burkett, ABB's Senior Vice President for Business Development. "So we invent a lot of new technology, particularly around high voltage." He says the project is more than just adding jobs to the 18 companies. "It's new technology," he says. "It's innovation. You would hope that the innovation is going to lead to new technology that can be commercialized, that can not only create jobs at ABB, but that can create new industries here. You look at the semiconductor market and how many people that employs, this has some real potential. And not just for Raleigh. It's a good indicator of what's going in the triangle," he says. "This region is being recognized more and more as a center of innovation." Costly, but promising. And if a new industry is born here, other companies will latch on to the triangle, he predicts, creating more buzz, more accolades, and more jobs. As Jay Baliga, the North Carolina State University professor behind the WBGS format, points out, companies such as ABB that traditionally play in the semiconductor space see the writing on the wall and know change is coming. They are well aware that their silicon power device business will be threatened by silicon carbide power devices and want to transition to this technology in the future, he says. The drawback? That high cost of manufacturing. By entering into the ground floor via this consortium, companies such as ABB and Vaken get an early head start on what Baliga promises is coming, with or without Obama's announcement. Without that $140 million, it would take longer, and another country would probably get there first. Obama pointed out in his speech that the country that figures out how to do this first, and the companies that figure out how to do this best, they're the ones that are going to attract the jobs that come with it. The 18 companies that were selected for the consortium are ABB, APEI, AVG, Cree, Delphi, Delta Products, DFR Solutions, Grid Bridge, Hesse Mechatronics, 2-6, IQE, John Deere, Monolith Semiconductor, RF Micro Devices, Toshiba International, Transform, USCI, and Vacon. The seven universities and labs who were selected for the consortium are NCSU, Arizona State University, Florida State University, University of California at Santa Barbara, Virginia Polytechnic Institute, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. And the headline that starts it off, Julian is returning to his home court. Renowned fashion designer Alexander Julian is coming home to Chapel Hill. After spending decades in New York and Connecticut building the Alexander Julian Company, the designer responsible for adding the checkered pattern to UNC Chapel Hill's basketball jerseys has bought a Greenbridge condo. After realizing that my wonderful sister and her husband had accommodated us for 125 weekends, I thought, they are saints, but we should get our own place, Julian says. The condo is nearly 60% furnished, with items from Julian's own furniture line, and the rest of the furniture comes from his wife's deceased mother, who collected English antiques. Julian says he will complete his move back home once he sells his 30-acre estate in Connecticut, which he says North Carolinians would consider a holler. He's got new projects lined up, too, with a new performance bicycle shop set to open in Chapel Hill. Julian also remains involved with the community. I'm on four boards in Chapel Hill, and I haven't even moved back yet, he says. New group for Triangle Women in Global Business. Women have a new opportunity to support international trade in the Triangle. The newly formed local chapter of the Organization of Women in International Trade. The organization's Greater Triangle chapter launched January 22 with remarks from North Carolina Secretary of Commerce Sharon Decker. Members of the chapter, which can include men, have access to career development, local networking, and access to an international database of women around the globe involved in international trade. International trade accounts for 22% of North Carolina's jobs. Law firms gear up for Echo Devo work. As the state moves toward a public-private partnership model for the North Carolina Department of Commerce, Raleigh law firms are positioning themselves. The Raleigh office of Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough is forming a new economic development team that will be led by law partner Dennis Wicker, a former North Carolina lieutenant governor and North Carolina House Majority Leader. Across town, the Raleigh office of the Kilpatrick Townsend in Stockton has hired longtime Wake County Economic Development Director Ken Atkins as its new Director of Economic Development. Other local firms that are active in economic development include Smith Anderson, Nexon Pruitt, Smith Moore Leatherwood, and Womble Carlisle. Local rock stars win national honors. Triangle Rock Club's youth climbing team, Team TRC, won top honors at the American Bouldering Series Divisional Championship held the weekend of January 11 in Des Moines, Iowa. The Wake County-based Team TRC fielded 17 youth climbers to compete with some of the strongest youth climbers in the nation. 10 of the 17 youth qualified to compete at Nationals in Colorado Springs, Colorado, beginning February 28. TRC's nationally qualified competitors are Jason Wills, Emma Grace Lehman, Charlie Osborne, Kaylee Ryan, Maylee Wagner, Alexa Russell, Mackenzie Tate, Mark Hartman, Cameron Mann, Paxton Mann, and reigning national champion Kai Leitner. I couldn't be more proud of all 17 competitors. All of our youth conducted themselves in a way that made all the parents and coaches proud, said Team TRC head coach Alex Neighbors. Anchor Capital touts investment by design. You may not have heard of Anchor Capital Management of Raleigh, but the annual meeting of this boutique investment house at the North Carolina Museum of Art on January 16 included many familiar faces in local business. Clay Dunnigan, who heads Anchor, tells Biz that 2013 was a good year for the firm, which manages about $20 million in assets for its clients. In his presentation, Dunnigan noted that the main fund generates 35.9% in annualized returns since its inception in 2008. Last year, it was about 45%. In the crowd listening to Dunnigan were Peyton Woodson III, one of the Triangle's noted philanthropers, Al Siemens, CEO of FHI 360, Larry Robbins, a partner at Wyrick Robbins, and Mount Airy-based Pike Electric Corporation CEO J. Eric Pike. After the short presentation, attendees were treated to a tour of the Art Museum's Porsche by Design exhibit, which left Biz salivating over these beautiful machines. But to the point, Biz believes we should follow Anchor's investment strategy closely in 2014, perhaps to bolster Biz's dwindling portfolio. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Dawn Curry, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we turn to A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we'll read Todd Cohen's column, the headline, Residential Farm Community to Serve Kids and Adults with Autism. Erin O'Loughlin was tapped out and exhausted and juggling life. She also was frustrated. It was December 2011, and O'Loughlin was having a tough time finding programs appropriate for her severely autistic son, then age 7, during the three-week track-out periods when his school was not open for classes. He has no options when he's tracked out, she says. There are options for kids with no special needs, but not for kids with special needs. Her frustration helped spark O'Loughlin's idea for a residential farm for adults with autism, along with programs for adults and children with autism. Three Irish Jewels Farm, which would be the first of its kind in Wake County, and only one of about 10 farm communities throughout the U.S. for people with autism, aims to help address growing demand for autism programs. One in 88 children in the U.S. have autism, yet despite the demand, programs and funding are limited, O'Loughlin says. The waiting list for federal funding through a Medicaid program that waives income restrictions for people with special needs, for example, can be as long as 8 or 9 years, she says. O'Loughlin, who has held marketing and fundraising jobs at nonprofits, is working full-time to develop plans, partnerships, and support for her new nonprofit. She has invested $20,000 of her own money, generated more than $300,000 in individual contributions, in-kind donations, and grants, including $250,000 over 5 years from the Samuel P. Mandel Foundation in Pennsylvania, and expects soon to receive a gift of $650,000 that would allow her to move ahead with buying and developing a site for the farm. Developing the facilities and programs could cost up to $3 million and take 2 to 3 years. She expects to operate the farm with a $3 million annual budget in partnership with GHA Autism Supports, a nonprofit in Albemarle that will operate the residential and day programs for adults. Plans include summer and track-out programs for children, a capital campaign to raise money to build 4 to 5 one-story homes, each serving 3 to 4 residents, a local farmer's market, on-site store for residents to sell their crafts, community shared agriculture for local individuals and restaurants, animals, activities such as gardening, landscaping, animal care and horse riding therapy, and a craft center, life skills center, and recreational programs. Services for people with autism are limited and are available for children only through age 22. Yet adults don't grow out of autism, O'Loughlin says. We have no game plan for them. And facilities for adults with autism are in crisis because government keeps cutting their funding, she says. Families living with autism need respite, need breaks, need to be understood, and don't need to feel guilty about it, O'Loughlin says. They also are panicked, she says. We don't know who's going to take care of our children when we're gone. While the farm she is developing will not begin to fill the big gap in services, she says, I want my child and some of these other children to have a future. And now on the same page, the nonprofit news. Construction for the new Kid Grid exhibit at Marble's Kids Museum in downtown Raleigh is well underway. The lights, colors, and movement in this exhibit are truly energizing, and seeing it jump off a blueprint and into real life is exhilarating, says Pam Hartley, Vice President of Play Experience. Kid Grid is funded by a $1 million grant from ABB, which provides power and automation technology and has North American headquarters in Cary. Kid Grid introduces children to the power grid, helps them make wise energy choices, and inspires interest in energy careers. The exhibit is expected to open in June. Bayer USA Foundation, the foundation of Bayer Crop Science, has awarded more than $70,000 to North Carolina nonprofit organizations, including Boys and Girls Clubs of Wake County, Dress for Success Triangle, John Avery Boys and Girls Club of Durham, Keep NC Beautiful, Lucy Daniels Center, Make-A-Wish Eastern North Carolina, North Carolina Theater, The Queens Foundation Incorporated, Shepherd's Table Soup Kitchen, and Wake Education Partnership. The gifts are part of the Bayer USA Foundation's almost $1.5 million in grants to U.S. nonprofits to support STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education. Cafe Carolina and Bakery raised $18,726 for Special Olympics North Carolina through its A Sweet Way to Help promotion as part of its sponsorship in the Over the Edge fundraiser to benefit Special Olympics. The campaign raised $242,000 for local athletes. And returning to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal, the headline we have is Debate Over Solarize Programs Heats Up, and this article is written by Dawn Curry with the Dateline of Raleigh. Programs meant to enhance the local solar power market are receiving backlash in the Triangle. Solarize Raleigh was first explored by the City of Raleigh in October 2013. The idea behind Solarize programs is to allow customers to buy from solar installers through a bulk purchase to receive a group discount, usually hovering around 15%. Those running the program choose the installers. The North Carolina Solar Center, NCSC, at NC State University, garnered a $15,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to administer Raleigh's program and began seeking feedback. What they heard was not what they expected. Solarize Raleigh is bad for business, says Jason Epstein, general manager of Baker Renewable Energy of Raleigh. Epstein also serves on the NCSC advisory board. Solarize insults customers by saying they are not smart enough to choose how to spend their money. Dan Lezama, owner of Raleigh-based Sun Dollar Energy, says the program will hurt small businesses. The program does not reduce prices, says Lezama, who studied the Solarize Asheville program, which he says hurt small solar businesses. Under the terms of this program, even with the supposed bulk discount, prices are still higher than what I offer my customers right now. That's because installers set their prices differently according to their overhead. Solarize projects require installers who can meet a high demand, have an established customer base, and a certain amount of jobs completed, which depends on the market. When the Solarize project first began in Portland, Oregon, it received the same criticism from small solar business owners, according to a March 2010 article in the Daily Journal of Commerce, Oregon. Small solar business owners in Portland said they couldn't meet a sudden demand and that quality would be sacrificed if they did. On January 16, NCSC held a meeting to receive feedback from installers. Steve Calland, NCSC's executive director, says installers would prefer the program to start out with customers in neighborhood clusters, similar to Portland's program, because installers felt this could benefit their business in the long run. Although Callan says the feedback was mostly good, Lizama says 10 out of the 12 installers said they were not in favor of the program. Meanwhile, a solarized Durham project sprang up, but not in partnership with NCSC or the City of Durham. Solarize Durham is run by NC Warn, a nonprofit organization geared towards encouraging a clean energy revolution. Executive Director Jim Warren says, yes, Solar Solutions of Cary was chosen as the program's installer. Callan says NCSC extended a helping hand to Solarize Durham. We offer to them the same technical assistance the Department of Energy would provide to any solarized project in the country, says Calland. They thought they had a handle on it. Calland thinks small business owners shouldn't worry. I think in general the concerns don't make a lot of sense to me, says Calland. What we have found out about the concerns that have been cited is that the program actually helps. The idea is that solarized programs help grow the local solar market because the program only lasts a short time, and solar panels have a way of being contagious. In fact, new research published in the journal Marketing Science shows that if his neighbor has solar panels, a consumer is 7.8% more likely to go solar too. Callan says word of mouth and keeping up with the Joneses attitude as a result of Solarize would ultimately be good for Raleigh's solar installation business. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we have the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And the first article for her is Big Plans for Raleigh Cary Retail Centers. Two Florida investor groups have bought the Terry Moore Square Retail Center on Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh, with plans to begin a renovation and to fill many of its vacant shop spaces by year-end. The new owners, a partnership of the Sembler Company of St. Petersburg, Florida, and Forge Capital of Tampa, Florida, paid $21 million for the 256,800-square-foot retail property in January. Terry Moore Square was 35% vacant at the time of the sale. Sembler CEO Ron Wheeler says the team is already working to attract a regional grocer and a retailer of fashion apparel, shoes, accessories, and home decor to help fill the vacant spaces in the center. He projects the new leases will boost occupancy to about 85% by late 2014. Four new restaurant and retail tenants have signed deals to open soon at the Waverly Place Shopping Center in Cary, and all four will be new brand concepts to the Triangle. T-Mac Sports Grill, formerly known as Taco Mac, already has three locations in Charlotte, and the company has been looking for expansion opportunities in the Triangle for several months. The T-Mac at Waverly Place is expected to open in May and will be its first location in the region. Violet's is a contemporary women's apparel and jewelry boutique that owner Hannah Ellis plans to open in April. Color Me Mine is a paint-it-yourself ceramic studio franchise. The Vom Fass Oil, Vinegar and Spices Shop, owned by franchisee Julie Ginsler, opened on January 19. The new Bass Pro Shops Sportsman Center store in Cary will open to the public on February 12, according to an announcement from the company. The much-anticipated 105,000-square-foot store will stock equipment, apparel, and products for just about any outdoor activity, from camping and fishing to hunting and boating. The store is located in the Harrison Square Shopping Center that's across from the SAS campus in Cary. And in court news, former Raleigh real estate developer slapped with 27-year federal prison sentence. James T. Webb, a former Bentley-driving Raleigh real estate developer who faced federal fraud charges for bilking investors out of nearly $12 million, has been sentenced to 27 years in federal prison. Webb must also make total restitution of the money to his more than 80 victims, according to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Raleigh. Webb, 52, of Leland, was accused of promising investors in multiple states quick, large, and safe financial gains by investing money with his real estate companies between 2002 and 2006, according to the court documents, but never delivering. Webb had promised investors that he would use the money to purchase, renovate, and resell properties to first-time home buyers in North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee. But evidence showed that many of the properties were never fully renovated or rented. Each home was supposed to be worth about $65,000. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission had, in 2007, filed suit against Webb, alleging that Webb sold fraudulent housing rehabilitation contracts that bilked more than 80 investors. The SEC said that Webb used the money for personal expenses such as leases on exotic cars and recreation travel, leaving investors to pay exorbitant mortgages. The investigation was conducted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the United States Postal Inspection Service, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development Office of the Inspector General, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Office of the Inspector General, with the assistance of the North Carolina Appraisal Board. Assistant U.S. Attorney William M. Gilmore prosecuted the case. And an HQ update. Carries Biologics inks deal for new $15 million office building. Oncology services company Biologics Incorporated has signed a long-term lease contract with Highwoods Properties to build a new $15 million office building for the company in Cary. Cary-based Biologics, led by President and CEO Stuart Franz, will occupy all of the new 75,000-square-foot, three-story building. It is expected to be completed in the second quarter of 2015, according to a January 16 news release from Highwoods. Highwoods will build the office building on 7 acres that the Raleigh-based Real Estate Investment Trust already owns on Weston Parkway in Cary. The property is near where Highwoods is also building a $110 million office campus for MetLife's new global technology and operations hub, and it boosts its pipeline of new development to about $227 million, that is 86% pre-leased. Biologics currently has its headquarters at 120 Western Oaks Court in Cary. And a reporter, Jason DeBrun's page, DeBrun covers healthcare and higher education. The headline of his article, Providers Vent in NCTRAC Survey. More than two-thirds of healthcare providers who responded to a survey say they are either barely satisfied or not satisfied at all with NCTRACs, the system that processes and pays Medicaid claims. That's according to data from a survey sent to more than 60,000 providers who see Medicaid patients. The survey was not approved by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees Medicaid in this state, or Computer Sciences Corporation, the vendor that built the NCTRAC system. It was circulated by Joe and Joseph Langley, a father and son team who simply say they were curious about the program after reading news reports about problems that providers have had with the system. The survey came just days before a group of doctors filed a class action lawsuit against DHHS last week over missed NCTRAC's payments. But the Langleys say the timing was pure coincidence. And on the page of reporter Lauren Onsorge, Onsorge covers infotech and entrepreneurism. And first she has some super numbers. $45,000. That's how much Matt Donegan, general sales manager at Capital Broadcasting-owned Fox 50, says is the going rate for a local 32nd Super Bowl spot. $1,093,900. That's how many people that spot would have reached last year. And in a section called Space Tech, the headline, Are We Alone? The answer may be as close as Durham. Optical imaging company Wasatch Photonics, a Utah company with a facility in Durham, could answer the age-old question on the European ExoMars mission in 2018. CEO Gerald Haidt explains how the spectrometer his company manufactures in Durham will help the team. Raman Spectroscopy is exciting the molecules with a specific laser beam. When you hit molecules with laser light, it excites them. They'll emit a photon, they'll emit light themselves. While the light level is too low for the human eye, it's easily scooped up by Wasatch technology, which can identify the makeup of the sample using the spectrum fingerprint. The mission, led by European Space Agency, with contributors from Russia, aims to detect possible evidence of past or present life on Mars, as well as to look for signs of water. If water or organic materials are there, the spectrometer will find them, Haidt says. A lot of samples from meteors, pieces of meteors that came to Earth, have shown the possibility that there is life on Mars, he says. I think the possibility of finding some kind of life on Mars is pretty high, but it's a big planet. And in another article on this page, the headline, there's even an app for firefighting. Entrepreneur's new system could save lives. Firefighter Patrick Jackson is merging his calling with Google Glass technology in a way that could change firefighting forever. Jackson, a 7-year veteran firefighter in Rocky Mount, has an app that allows firefighters to respond to calls quickly. Currently on Android and Apple platforms, it's being rolled out into the Google Glass format. His new app can receive instant notifications and information about response calls, everything from a structure fire to a cardiac arrest, giving firefighters addresses and incident information faster than their radios can. We're using it in our fire department on iPads, he says, adding that iPads have been installed in all 7 of Rocky Mount's frontline engines. When a call comes in on the 9/11 center, the information goes to those iPads. That information includes a map of the location and whereabouts of the closest fire hydrant. It comes in about 30 seconds quicker than that radio. 30 seconds in a fire can mean a lot, or for a heart attack, he says. And a Google Glass application would mean a hands-free version. I see this as an even quicker way to get that information, he adds. Nobody's ever done anything like this with the fire department. I think it can definitely be a tool for firefighters. Jackson, who submitted his proposal to the Google Glass Explorer program in order to get his hands on the device, says he's already hearing from other departments interested in the technology, even the department in New York City. That's where it gets really interesting. FDNY reached out to him through Google, interested in adding thermal imagery to what he's already doing with the technology. It's all talk at this point, but hopefully we can come up with something, he says. It could be incorporated into a fire engine mask. I think it has huge potential. It would save lives, and the technology is getting to where it's smaller. Everything is smaller and cheaper. We're getting to the point where this kind of technology could be made to equip every firefighter. ABB expands footprint at Centennial Campus. ABB, one of 18 growth plants, the Switzerland-based company which develops power and automation technologies for utility and industrial customers, is moving its 350 power products and power systems employees into the new Alliance One building on NCSU's Centennial campus. ABB's Corporate Research Center will remain on the first 2 floors at its 940 Main Campus Drive building, which will be refreshed and upgraded, according to a company statement. The move is planned for 2015 and puts ABB in 3 of the 5 floors at Alliance One. Currently, ABB has a research facility at Centennial Campus and a North American headquarters in Cary. The news comes on the heels of an Obama announcement that lists ABB as one of 18 firms across the country working to develop technologies to power next-generation electronics as part of a nationwide manufacturing innovation consortium. ABB spokesperson Melissa London says the Centennial expansion was going to happen with or without the Obama project, but the timing and proximity are ideal. While details of the new manufacturing consortium at NCSU are still being worked out, officials expect the new innovation center to be housed at Centennial Campus. And finally, in the tech report, North Carolina IT openings are in a holding pattern. The latest IT job trends report released by the North Carolina Technology Association shows a stagnant job opening number, 3,230 openings in the month of December. That's exactly the same as the November number in North Carolina. The top 3 categories for job openings: systems engineering support, IT management, software development. The top 3 needed skills for those openings: SQL, Java, Windows OS. And on reporter Dawn Curry's page, Curry covers money and small business. The main article headline, will North Carolina be stung by contract cuts? Although federal contracts are losing steam and putting companies that depend on those contracts in a pinch, North Carolina businesses may not feel the impact as strongly as those in other states. The total value of federal contracts fell by $58 billion during the last fiscal year, roughly an 11% drop, according to an analysis by the New York Times. But in his remarks at the recent Economic Forecast Forum hosted by the North Carolina Bankers Association, Scott Dorney, executive director of the North Carolina Military Business Center, noted that North Carolina's federal contracts aren't as dependent on the military as other states. The federal contracting environment will be challenging, but still lucrative for many businesses, Dorney says. Federal contracting here in North Carolina is not about tanks, planes, and submarines, because we don't do final assembly of major weapon systems, vehicles, ships, airplanes, or other high-dollar items for DOD. Therefore, as budgets decline and procurement of large systems take a hit, the impact on us is moderate, he says. According to Dorney, the greatest impact on North Carolina businesses will come with the end of the construction boom as major projects are being completed. Susan Acker Walsh, COO of population health company Symetrica LLC, points out that the decline in federal contracting didn't happen overnight. I think the federal contracting landscape has been changing over the last few years, where the landscape has been influenced by budget constraints coming from Washington, Walsh says. What we see is that there are fewer procurements in the system. Some of them are withdrawn after they are released due to sequestration. Other procurements have a delayed release or adjudication or award process. Symetrica gets most of its business from the federal government, but Walsh says smaller companies will likely be more affected by the shift. And another article on this page, NCSU study debunks electric car myths. If you think buying a hybrid, plug-in hybrid, or battery electric vehicle will save the planet, think again. Researchers at NC State University conducted a study that shows even a sharp increase in the use of electronic drive vehicles, EDVs, would not significantly reduce emissions by 2050. The researchers studied 108 different scenarios in a model to determine the impact EDVs would have on emissions between now and 2050, and found that even if EDVs made up 42% of such vehicles in the U.S., there would be little or no reduction in the emission of key air pollutants. Joseph DeCarolis, assistant professor of civil, construction, and environmental engineering at NCSU, was the senior author of a paper published on the study's findings. There are a number of reasons for this, DeCarolis says in a release. In part, it's because some of the benefits of EDVs are wiped out by higher emissions from power plants. Another factor is that passenger vehicles make up a relatively small share of total emissions, limiting the potential impact of EDVs in the first place. For example, passenger vehicles make up only 20% of carbon dioxide emissions. From a policy standpoint, this study tells us that it makes more sense to set emissions reduction goals rather than promoting specific vehicle technologies with the idea that they'll solve the problem on their own. Meanwhile, NCSU's North Carolina Solar Center has rolled out a public education campaign that cites vehicles as the number one source of air pollution in North Carolina's urban areas. So what's the true benefit of driving an electric car? Arguably, it's gas savings. According to the campaign, an efficient gasoline vehicle costs $1,350 in fuel driving per 15,000 annual miles, while an electric vehicle costs $450. And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can of the guest column on the Viewpoint page. The headline, North Carolina solar energy projects are attracting investors of all sizes. From Aquesta Bank in the Lake Norman area to Apple Incorporated in Catawba County, companies are investing in solar power across North Carolina. Solar power generation has become one of the most affordable energy sources today, supplying energy to the grid at a fixed cost for up to 15 years. For corporate chief executives, chief financial officers, and treasurers, solar provides a unique investment opportunity to earn above-market returns while supporting the growth of clean, renewable energy in their communities. Until recently, energy investments were made only by institutional investors and utilities that could deploy billions of dollars into large, centralized power plants. All energy investments in critical infrastructure receive some form of tax incentive. The majority of the tax benefits in energy are generated through investments in fossil fuels. What makes solar different is that companies, both large and small, can invest in projects that fit their own appetite. Solar revenue is generated from long-term fixed-income contracts with investment-grade utilities. Solar power plants have no moving parts and a strong track record of performance that's above expected output. Financially conservative companies, such as Warren Buffett's MidAmerican Energy, along with banks and insurance companies, have invested in partnerships that own large solar farms because they feel comfortable with the return and the underlying assets. Take risk-averse community lender Aquesta Bank as an example. After installing a rooftop system on its Cornelius headquarters 4 years ago, Aquesta made the decision to invest in solar at all of its branches. In Charlotte, Fifth Third Bank has developed a solar financing team for the entire Southeast after the bank provided financing to several O2 Energy's solar farms in North Carolina. We see hotels, software companies, race team owners, rock quarries, large retailers, and even railroad companies investing in partnerships that own solar farms across the state. This corporate investment in solar projects has led manufacturers to locate production facilities across North Carolina to supply the growing industry, creating much-needed short-term installation, work, and long-term careers in our state. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.
Online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.